David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. As we noted in the past, we like dwelling in and going deep into discussions around education, primarily of the Black child. And a couple of weeks ago, we had a great conversation that really looked at critical race theory, and we had the mother of mothers when it comes to that. If Derrick Bell is the father, we had the mother on. You know, Gloria Lanvin Billings to really break that down. And she pulled out all types of receipts. Today, we want to have a discussion about educating the Black child, but in particular with Black girls. Want to find out what they're dealing with. And from just my, you know, cursory knowledge, it seems like a lot of our girls are going through some things. We're hearing higher rates of suicide and depression. There are reports out that are talking about the impact of social media that is, you know, impacting the psyche of our Black girls. I don't know how current movements like the Me Too movement lands on Black girls, but I'm sure that is in the wind as well. And we have a couple of people to speak on it. Of course, we have Hadari Davis, whose organization, Edutainment for Equity. So Hadari brings in a lot of people to have these discussions. And today he has somebody who is a freedom fighter, a psychologist, a professor, a therapist. I think those are kind of the same. And, you know, and we were just joking because she's out of Illinois, outside of Chicago. And I thought maybe she had one book, maybe two, but she was, she was like, well, let me tell you about my books. And, you know, one of them, the Intersection Qualified, Qualitative Research, that's for academic folks, Black Feminism. And I didn't get the whole title, but that's an academic thing. Then she has a Boss Chick's Guide to Mindfulness, Meditation, and of course her book, Teaching Black Girls. And that's the tip of the iceberg. Her name, for folks who don't know, and I'm gonna make sure I get it, it is Dr. V, Venus Evans Winters. But people who know her and love her call her Dr. V. So welcome to the show, and how you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you, Dave, for having me here.
Let me start off with you, Hadari. Over the years, we've seen these conversations. From your estimation, if you can put on your educator hat, where do Black girls land in these discussions from how you've seen it? Obviously, enough that we're having the discussion today, but what has been your observation as an educator?
I think a lot of the challenges that Black boys are facing are similar to the challenges that Black girls are facing. I think there's also some unique challenges that Black girls endure, especially in the context of having a lack of representation, a lack of agency, a lack of advocacy for their positionality in the schools. We've seen a rise in Black men and boys, especially under Obama. A lot of resources went to support male achievement, particularly in the Bay Area. Not as many resources were funneled to support Black girls. The same types of systems that were created around Black boys were not created around Black girls. So when we see incarceration rates, when we see suspension rates, when we see discipline practices, the same things that Black boys have been enduring in schools with regard to anti-Blackness and incarceration have been what Black girls are facing, the same challenges, but not necessarily met with the same infrastructural interventions, and not necessarily taking into account in the long term the humanity of these girls, who they're becoming, who we need them to become in our communities, and what our role is, not just as educators, but as community members, to foster you know, the elevation of these girls so that our futures can be secured. And that, to me, is the point of the whole conversation. We center this conversation on children, but we're also recognizing that 20 years from now, these children are going to be the parents. They're going to be the breadwinners. They're going to be the people who represent our communities. They're going to be the activists and the educators and the organizers, and maybe even a radio DJ or two. They're going to be the one telling the story. They're going to be the one carrying the struggle forward. And it's on us in this generation to really create the space and platform for them to thrive.
Appreciate that. Dr. V, how are you seeing the terrain? Obviously, you work directly with Black girls, so you would have a much deeper analysis, but let me maybe preface this a little. I think the enduring images that we see of Black girls as of late tend to be police officers treating them as criminals. You know, it's just last week we saw a police officer slamming a Black girl, you know, down in LA. You know, we see, you know, we all seen the image of the cop flipping the Black girl in South Carolina. Words like incorrigible, defiant, sassy, those type of adjectives are often pointed to Black girls. And I find it to be kind of odd because when we look at the rates of graduation and we look at the success stories, it is Black girls or Black women, you know, going and really doing the damn thing, if we may. But what are you seeing that we're missing? Because those seem to be the two dominant narratives, with them not with the narrative of Black girls being folks who just don't comply, need to be put in their place, being a dominant one in many circles.
Mm-hmm. I like the way that you phrased it. You have these two dominant narratives. And so what Hadari is talking about is pathways to criminalization, as Monique Morris refers to it, right? And she's right from Oakland too, so you all could appreciate that reference. Right. She talks about that in her book, Push Out. The other dominant narrative that we all heard, especially during the Obama administration and probably prior to the Obama administration, is that Black girls were doing good in school and that Black women were doing even better, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have these two dominant narratives of those Black girls who are being oppressed and suppressed and beat up by adult men in their schools, right? And on the streets. And then this other narrative that Black women are achieving. Now, what's interesting, Davey and Hadari, because you're right, I actually see multiple lenses. And so, Davey, I did break up with my oppressor December 15th at 12 p.m. Central Time, 2020, during the pandemic. And the reason why I left the academy, even as a full professor, is because I saw that Black people, Black women and girls needed something at that time. And I honestly could not triage white girls. I thought that it was unethical, considering that during the Civil Rights Movement, they called for three entryways, point of entries for Black people. Academia wasn't on the list. They right. called for more teachers, more nurses, social workers, and lawyers.
Right.
Okay. So those main four. But of course, the other three I was totally interested in for obvious reasons. And so I am a licensed clinical social worker. I'm a clinical psychotherapist in private practice and a certified clinical trauma professional. Okay. So right. your girl is seeing it from all angles. And I work closely with the courts. And right now we're just fighting for young women. Black women, poor women, to be able to parent during a pandemic. So let's talk about these dominant narratives. By the way, I also work for that think tank that Hadari was also referencing, which is the African American Policy Forum and the report on Black Girls Matters. Right. Where the data is showing that when we look at national or federal resources, much is being poured into right now Black boys and Latino boys properly, Latinx boys across the spectrum. And so when we think about that, Black girls are literally falling through the cracks of these two dominant narratives. They're falling to the cracks. And so when we talk about the Black women or the Black girls that are doing well in this educational system, this colonized system, we need to ask at what cost.
Right. And what are the costs?
What are the costs? Very good question. So think about it. I just told you all I jumped ship during the pandemic.
Right.
Like, I can't triage this particular population at this time. It's unethical, if not immoral, when you're working from a Pan-African framework. So when you think about that situation, if I am the visible face of educational achievement and success, what do you think our young women and girls are going through who have less resources and less options when it comes to jumping ship? And so what other costs? Is depression?
Mm-hmm.
It's anxiety? And it's irritability. And it's really a disconnect for who they have to be. Now, you can only disconnect from who you are culturally and spiritually in order to achieve in a particular environment before you have a psychotic break, or as the Black as the black community like to say, before you lose your mind. Y'all gonna make me lose my mind up in here, up in here. And so many of our high achieving black girls are, you know, are suffering in plain sight. And our other black girls, or all black girls, are being pathologized and criminalized in our, right, our school systems.
Dr. V, as you were talking, the first thing that came to my mind with Maya Angelou's poem, The Mask, well, actually with, I mean, she Paul did Lawrence it. Dunbar. Lawrence Dunbar did it first, but she flipped that and kind of made it her own in many ways. Mm-hmm. As you were speaking, you know, I would normally on the air play the poem, but you have to actually see her face to really appreciate when she does it. I bring this up to ask because I guess there's a third narrative that is often levied on black women, the strong black women. So when we walk in a room, we go, this white woman here needs help. She seems very fragile. Let's lift her up and everybody else. Dr. V, you strong black woman, you got it. And so we oftentimes see our sisters as impenetrable and invulnerable to a lot of things. And so we overlook. And when you started talking about depression and anxiety and things like that, I'm just thinking about many of the women that I've come across who have to literally put on that mask. And then when they let loose, it's like a whole other world, you know. Mm-hmm. And they talk about the micromanaging, the microaggressions, the deliberate and oftentimes systemic undermining that they're dealing with on a professional level. And I can only imagine, and this is what I'm leading to, is that playing out in the classrooms as well? And if so, mm-hmm. at what age is it, you know, are girls allowed to be girls, or do they find themselves being upended even at early ages like 6 or 7?
Mm-hmm. Dave, first of all, thank you for referring to me as a strong black woman, SBW. But actually, I'm not. I'm a vulnerable black woman who's resilient.
Right.
And I want to take that word back out of hands of white people and grit, right? Because they don't own resilience. And people, you know, say, oh my God, don't just tell us to be resilient. But resiliency is actually a protective factor. It's a coping strategy. It's a psychological defense that's actually positive. It means that you have been through some stuff. I won't curse Hadari, don't worry. That you, because I don't know who the public audience is, you know what I'm saying? But I am from Chicago. That's how you get resilient. You got to cuss every now and again. You right. see what I'm saying? And so I am definitely resilient. That means that I've learned to put in place certain protective factors to protect me physically, mentally, socially, spiritually, and psychologically. Hence the Boss Chick's Guide to Mindfulness Meditation. You have to meditate a lot. Right. And so I say that too, to hint to Hadari. He said, one day these girls and these boys are gonna grow up. That's true. We're part of larger families and communities, and our schools try to rob that from us. Now, what happens, Dave, is when we put these black girls in these schools' context, they don't necessarily, and not, I would say in many cases, but in most cases, they do not look like their home or community environment. So what does that mean? How did I become resilient? How did you become resilient? How did Hadari become resilient? We became resilient because our parents did have expectations of us. As a black girl, my expectation was to help in the domestic sphere. That means help clean the house, help take care of other kids, help take care of the elders. And also we did put back then the men first. I mean, you just did, you know, the right. dad got the last piece of meat, you know, cause he worked the longest, things like that. Don't eat that last piece of chicken. You know, did you serve your dad or your grandpa or your uncle? Things like that. We right. can deconstruct that at another time. What does that mean? But as far as what that means for black girls, you can't take that same black girl who has expectations to help her mother, help her grandmothers, help the other children in the family, in the neighborhood, and then tell her to be docile in that school environment. That could be actually not just detrimental to who she is outside of that school, but it could be detrimental to who she will become, right? Mm-hmm. And so we learned our tenacity, our that strength that you're naming, that resilience, it actually comes from knowing when to take the lead, not necessarily when being told to take the lead. It also requires us to have the ability to bounce back. Now, what happens when you tell the girls to bounce back? Okay, the school environment, it's oppressive. You don't want to regulate someone to oppressive conditions. That's counterintuitive to who we are as Africans. It just does not make sense.
For people listening.
But you got a fragile white woman's psychology alongside the a resilient Black girl's psychology. And this is research. So research shows, Dave and Hadari, that Black girls actually have higher self-esteem than any other group of girls in this country, whereas white women have the lowest self-esteem than any other group in this country. Black girls also are showing stronger leadership qualities than any other group of girls in this country, whereas white women have lesser leadership skills. So you're going to put a 25-year-old young woman, white woman, in the face of a 12-year-old Black girl who has been socialized for tenacity and to resist adversity. It's a cocktail for disaster.
It's called being threatening. Mm-hmm. You're a threat, and you get viewed in a different way. And, you know, in Hadari, as an educator as well, either one of you can jump in on this, but as you get older, depending on how you speak and show that leadership quality, you often got labeled uppity and needed to be put in your place. And there's a whole history of that. The uppity, you know, these uppity Black women need to, you know, so, but this clash of cultures is one of the roots of it, you know. Can we speak about that? Because what is being asked then is for people to tone it down, dial it back. And not only is it an expectation of society to a certain degree, it also seemed like something that was kind of suggested when you had people like Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan doing his report and everything, where it was kind of like, if only the sisters tone it down, maybe the man can kind of strut, or at least that's what I was reading in what's the name's book, When and Where I Enter, Paula Gidding's book, right? So yeah. So how do we deal with that? Because it seems like what I was saying before, systemically, we're telling you to fall back in, and we're undermining who you are from an early age.
Yeah, I'll just say that that's probably true for Black people generally in American schools. And when I say Black people, I'm not just talking about the children. I'm talking about the teachers, the professors, the scholars. We're all told to tone it down. That, I mean, this whole sort of con against critical race theory is trying to influence people to tone it down, to change our language, to watch what we say, to watch how we light a fire under this next generation to continue this struggle. I think for Black girls, I think everything that Dr. V is saying is really critical when you talk about the future of our community. You know, if Black girls are being made to suppress their identities, if Black girls are being made to suppress their instincts, suppress their genius in order to fit into a society that won't accept them unless they are docile. And it just sounds so much like the past of African-American history. It sounds like, despite the fact that Black women become lawyers and doctors, and despite the fact that Black women run businesses, become successful entrepreneurs, become clinicians, become professors, scholars, write major books, despite all of that, in this society, they're seen, they need to be in the back room, cleaning that couch, preparing a drink, making some food, and raising somebody else's baby. This is like a psychological trope. Another kind of new sort of consistent trope that I'm seeing is the Black girl magic trope. This sort of extraordinary Black girl who does things that no other Black girl could ever do. Whether it's Amanda Gorman or the young woman who won the spelling bee, it's like they're almost treated like they're Black girl superheroes, and that they're so different from the norm, when in fact, I think in the Black community, those are just the regular Black girls. Like, you know how many I'm not gonna take away from Amanda Gorman's genius. She's a great poet. But I mean, I was at Brave New Voices and at You Speak.
Yes.
Do you know how many powerful Black women and Black girls have been busting poems for the past 20 years that would have been equally as powerful, if not more, than Amanda's poem. And, you know, my daughters could spell. Like, I know a lot of Black women that can spell and dribble a basketball, actually, at the same time. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily extraordinary, that phrase. And I thought that Dr. Billings last time we had this conversation, she said it great. She's like, there's nothing extraordinary about them. They're like regular Black girls. It's like magic is everywhere.
But when you say this is a magical thing, what it does then, it makes it seem like maybe my daughter or your daughter or somebody else can't do it because this is some extraordinary stuff. Whereas, you know, my daughter knows, like, you need to spell and you need to be able to do these other things.
I see it as an institutional trick, though. It's like, it's like everything else. It's like, let's not look at the social determinants of how these things come about. Let's just look at the individual. Let's turn away from the institutional, the systemic, all those things that contribute to the reality of these lives. Let's instead focus on, you know, she must have some incredible spelling gene or some like mutant power in her ability to dribble five basketballs and spell at the same time. It's like the idea of extraordinary actually further limits the power, capacity, and potential of Black girls on the whole.
And it's also an indication that people don't go to the community. I'm just thinking about, you know, my older cousins and aunties that could just double dutch. Wasn't that a spelling game as you were doing that?
Right.
and crazy hand-eye coordination or crazy foot-hand coordination. Dr. V, let me ask you this. What is your prescription for teaching Black girls? What is missing in the classroom at this point in time? You know, that's one of the things you're going to be in deep conversation with Hadari and his team about. But, you know, what's the synopsis, you know?
Yeah, when it comes to pedagogy, you know, Hadari and his whole squad, they're like the master teachers, right? So it's kind of hard to, you know, volley off of that. But with that said, you know, I think it's getting at what you all are talking about. We do need to move away from this Black exceptionality story, you know, where everybody's tweeting, retweeting, hashtagging, sharing all kinds of stuff. You know, we shouldn't have a Black girl who has to play like the bass violin, the clarinet, and be the world's best gymnast to get any attention for her abilities, right? And so a lot of that actually, that exceptionality, it's coming out of eugenicism movement. So sometimes what we do as academics is we'll sit up there and try to take what white people have already done and then try to make it our own, not understanding that we're pulling from a whole ideology that's basically a copycat of white supremacy ideology. So it's not going to work for us. It's probably going to help one or two people, right? And so what we have to talk about is not Black girl exceptionality or Black girl magic. I think that's beautiful. Like Adari said, I see magic all around me, right? But what I want to really talk about is Black girl power. So Black girl power is figuring out an education for, okay, not schooling, but education for economic empowerment, political empowerment, and cultural empowerment. And so now it's even taboo to talk about, you know, economic empowerment, but how are you going to survive, you know, in this country and you don't have an economic plan? And some people forget about that as a spokes of Black power. They want to walk around in dashikis, but they don't want us to figure out how to make some money to sustain our families, you know, in the next generation. It's taboo, especially for Black girls, right? We are the bastards of all the movements for the most part. And so when you think about Black girl power as political, what we're talking about is, I predicted this on January 23rd. Yes, the insurrections, right? I said, oh shit. Oh, that didn't last long. That's because it's my coffee time over here in the Midwest. I said, oh man, guess what? There's going to be a backlash against Black girls and gender non-conforming girls or people. You know why? Because who was seen on those front lines in front of the television? And then we threw Kamala up there and Michelle Obama. I said, guess who's going to be slammed on the concrete? Guess who's going to be incarcerated and jailed? Guess who's going to be messed with at schools. Sure enough, already there's been over 50-some documented incidences of police officers harming Black women, and it's not even talked about. So the deaths did not stop, right? We're so lucky to have one.
Well, this is an extension of this is an extension to put them in their place. Oh, you
exactly.
got these.
We're gonna put them in their place. Who do they think they are? We're gonna show them that we're gonna put their light out, right? And so we have to talk about economic power alongside political power. We also have to talk about cultural power. And I do think that is what, you know, Edutainment for Equity does do. That's exactly what their agenda is. And it's what many of us who are part of the Pan-African community attempt to do. Now, what we do have to do, which Hadari is brave enough to do, is we do have to understand from an African-centered perspective, we have this continuum of the masculine and the feminine, or femininity and masculinity. That's Eurocentric and Western to see it as two binaries, parallel entities. That's what had us serving the men folk when I was growing up first, right, and last. Well, we have to see it as a continuum, because at some point we're going to come together.
Right.
We're going to come up, So what does that pedagogy look like? It has to be a pedagogy that centers both race and gender. Now, we're not talking about white supremacist race and racism. We're talking about the social reality that we still live in a racist society. So how do we teach our children to uprise against that, to persist and to resist? So what does a resistance strategy look like? From a gender perspective, what does gender liberation look like for both men and women and other genders who fall all in between there? Okay. Right. Until we figure this out. I put on Twitter that yesterday I showed my daughter this psychological illusion, you know, where you have the old woman and the young lady, and whoever sees it, that's what they see. You know, and my daughter told me, I said, daughter, what do you see? She said, I don't know. I see a man in like a coat and a hat. And I said, a coat and a hat? I said, this is an old lady or a young lady. She said, you can't expect me to gender nobody based off an image. So it doesn't matter what our beliefs are. Our children are making up their own minds. So how do we support them in the social cultural context that they have been given? And how do we, in the spirit of Sankofa, how do we move forward? And Davey, I don't think we can be afraid. These white girls ain't gonna save us. Man, they dealing with their own mess. You know who we dealing with? We dealing with these R. Kellys. Just saying. We dealing with white male police officers. We're dealing with white teachers who don't even know themselves. Look at the ACEs. It's coming right out of y'all hometown in LA. Look at the ACEs. When you look at the Kaiser Permanente study, the people who had the highest ACEs are adverse childhood experiences are actually white people, white middle-class people. So they are dealing with their own mental health and social emotional health issues. They are. So they're not going to be our answers. The problem is that white supremacy, these institutions, schools, the legal system, the medical system. We're talking about dismantle the police. We got to dismantle the medical system, our schools. So we have to think from a cultural perspective. So that's what it looks like for Black girls.
You said something that I don't want to go over people's head. You used the word uprising, you know, when you were describing what needs to take place in these classrooms in dealing with that. And that lies... That becomes the threat. That becomes the problem that people say they have, quotations around the word problem, because you're talking about resistance, and resistance leads to that resiliency. So how do we start to tackle that? Because that becomes a very scary thing, you know? If you start talking like Dr. V, you're not gonna get a job. If you start resisting like Kat Brooks,
Black women have never been a threat to this democracy. If anything, we've only added to it. We've only made it better. We saw that in the last election cycle. But what's happening, Davey, it's like when you're in a mental health ward, and if you're in a prison, if you put a normal neurotypical person in those environments, they begin to act like the prisoners. They begin to act like those who are in a mental health ward, right? Psychotic. And so what's happening is, and this is real, there's always been independent Black institutions since we got here. But of course, in the 60s and 70s, we've seen them everywhere, right? And so I'm not saying that's going to be the only answer or the answer for everybody. So when we're talking about uprising, we're talking about dismantling and rebuilding together.
Well, I hear you on that.
But I want to just say that the example that we see now of uprising is that white parents, maybe they don't even have kids in that school district, but they're willing to go to the school board and bang on the board for what they believe in. They're willing to bang against critical race theory. They're willing to bang against mask mandates. They're willing to bang against vaccinations. They're willing to bang against the removal of police from their campuses. Like, and it's not the children of the schools who are the ones out there banging. And many times it's not even the parents of the kids in those schools. It's like there are political operatives, there's a political agenda, and there is a team, an army of people who are willing to go into school boards and demand what they want. And these are the kinds of strategies that reflect words like uprising. Like there are every strategy isn't going to work everywhere. Obviously, you need different strategies to deal with large school districts that are small districts that have only one high school rather than to those who have 17 high schools. But the strategy to, at least in terms of dismantling these institutional practices within schools, is really about uprising. And it's not just about the students. It's not just about Black girls. It's about all those who advocate for the elevation of Black people. All of those who advocate for the elevation of Black people should be considering strategies of how to uprise in these school districts and in these school boards.
Well, Hadar, you pointed out what I was getting at. When we're basically talking about a power shift, a paradigm shift, and I'm in agreement with that. But if we're going to take that walk, then we have to have a lot of the support systems and we got to have strategies in place. And I'm afraid that some of the strategies that are being advocated fall short of the mark, you know, if we're not careful. So, you know, it could be, you know, I'm just going to make a TikTok video and I think I did my work. And what was not included was having a deep, maybe Pan-African understanding of the world around us. Right. So if we don't do that, then we may have, you know, my daughter go to school and say, I don't deal with these Haitians and these Jamaicans. And, you know, because that now is seeped into the conversation and words like uprising and woke and all that will be used. But then you also have in this mindset, a nativist type of attitude, which is an extension of white supremacy, right? Just to use that as one example. The other thing could be what we now call cancel culture, right? So we may have to struggle if we have a different opinion about something, right? If you call me Dave and I want you to call me David and I call you, you know, V instead of Venus, you know, all of a sudden my reaction is like, I ain't have nothing to say to her. We gonna cancel her out and I'm gonna uprise on that. Instead of sitting back and saying, well, let's struggle to get the correct analysis. And what does that look like when we have conversations? So I guess what I'm looking at is, you know, do we have in our teachings, in our education, ways in which people start to really engage one another principally? Do we have sets of criteria that we can all dwell into? Like, do we read a certain amount of books or do we look at certain scholars and philosophies? So when we come together, we kind of have a worldview of how things work versus me watching Fox News and you watching Democracy Now. We have two different worldviews that inform how we're going to engage one another. I'm going to be combative and you're going to be more thoughtful and we're going to be at odds in a very deliberate sense from, you know, because the outside will amplify the weakness within our community. And we see that happening. This goes to my last thing about cultural, I think you said, cultural pedagogy. I think that was the word you used, because you see that now. We will amplify one part of Black womanhood and downplay the other. You know, I love Cardi B and I love Megan and all of them, but I also love Saw Rock and Rhapsody and, you know, and Ryan Nicole, and they're not amplified, not by us and not by the society at large. So our expectations or even understanding of Black women is limited based upon how we are mass socialized.
Yeah, and I think that that's important because clearly we all have different conceptualizations, and Hadari's idea of uprising reminds me too of this. We do have to, I want to be realistic because I have, I'll write these court reports, so let's be clear, to be honest. But we also have to have a healing component because the first thing I thought with this idea of uprising, we also have, you know, I was thinking Kundalini rising. So we have to also heal. I mean, people are underestimated. We're talking about 400 years of slavery, chattel slavery in this country, another 200-300 years of just oppressive, segregating conditions, right? That has left us at the bottom of the well. And so when you talk about readings, I read Fanon. Fanon is a starting point. Read Marimbi Ani, another starting point. Jacob Carruthers, you know, so we have blueprints for healing. And so when you're talking about that young sister, like, look, I like to keep it real. Now you're going to have kids, like I've watched Hadari kids pretty much grow up in pictures, right?
Right.
You're going to have those kids. Now there are people who still are going to, when I'm still going to mess with them, still going to try to get in their head, still going to have to get to them. And they may have more ways of reacting to those oppressive conditions, right? Or that bullying, racial bullying in ways that other kids won't. Now let me take another kid who I haven't been privy watching. I've only read their documents in school paperwork, medical paperwork, or previous court documents. Let's be realistic. We do have kids in our schools who their mothers were victims of domestic violence. Their grandmothers were victims of domestic violence. Their great-grandmother was victims of domestic violence. And they survived Mississippi barely.
Right, right.
And then if you're a part of my generation and Hadari's generation, we've survived mass incarceration. We've seen the police come and terrorize our neighborhoods. Like we're in a developing country somewhere, like we're in Afghanistan. They got reparations, we still waiting. You see what I'm saying? And so we've seen a mass destruction of our communities. That's going to sit in the body. We need healing modalities as a part of our pedagogies. Right. Culture alone will not be the answer. And that's the one thing that Fanon and Marimbi Ani do talk about. So again, that's why I had to jump ship. And I'm using those words intentionally, y'all know that, right? But that's the reason why I had to jump ship. And I had to triage my own because we do need to deal with that transgenerational, intergenerational trauma. We don't like to name it. If we don't name it, we're going to keep giving it to these white psychologists, white psychiatrists, prison social workers, and they're going to take control of the narrative. Hadari and I have seen them hijack what we were calling for in the 60s and the 70s during the Black Panthers movement, saying, no, our kids need counselors. Our kids will need exactly what Fanon said. There will be consequences to putting our children in front of white people for majority of their childhood. They knew that. Right. They knew that. And I think it's giving too much power. You want to talk about white magic power? We give too much power to white people. Okay. Sometimes, and we blame them for all of our problems. They're definitely the impetus for most, for many, but we also have other issues. So for example, we've been harboring pedophiles in plain sight for decades.
And still defending them.
And still defending
them. You still got people defending R. Kelly to this day.
To this day, and come after people like me who say, hey, y'all, let's just empathize with those sisters who are survivors. Well, why we got to do this? And I'm like, really? So, you know, so we have trapped inside of our bodies. And that's why I never, you know, separate spirituality from education.
Yeah.
We need to heal, y'all. And we can't let we can't leave it up to a 25-year-old teacher to regulate the bodies of our children because they read one pamphlet on trauma, and that's the new scapegoat. Before that, we had SEL as a scapegoat. Well, if they only have social emotional, you know, learning, right? Before that, well, it was No Child Left Behind. We can have scripted curriculum and it will solve all the problems. It's going to take many resources, and we're going to have to come from many angles.
Is your book A Boss Chick's Guide to Mindfulness Meditation, does that help with that healing?
It does. So what I do is I basically recenter the conversation around meditation and mindfulness. And even I'm a hypnotherapist as well. And as a clinical trauma professional, sometimes Black people, we get scared to talk about like the spirituality and the somatic abolition work. But the reality is ours. Like, it's really ours. It comes from commit. And usually I'm the only Black, maybe one or two Black people, African people who are even sitting in these hypnotherapy trainings or meditation trainings. They tell you, oh, yeah, we got this right from, you know, Egypt, or this came from, you know, you like, whoa. But that's not how it's sold. So just like a lot of things, it's sold to us and repackaged, you know, and sold to us at a higher price. So I just let our people know some of the history without being too academic. And then I jump right into the work.
Real talk. Look, we're going to wrap things up here. We can go on and on and on. Yeah, because I still got a lot of questions about your other books. Sure. But you're going to be having a long conversation with Hadari and his team. For people listening, Hadari, let everybody know where what's happening, how they can connect, and then we'll get how we can connect directly with you, Dr. V.
So at Edutainment for Equity, we've been sponsoring a conversation around educating Black children.
But you got to say that again. You were going in and out.
As Edutainment for Equity, we have been sponsoring an event for the past 4 or 5 years around educating Black children. It started actually with a conversation on Hard Knock Radio with you, Davey D, and I think Dave Stovall. Mm. And since then, we've probably had about 25 or 30 different conversations and featured different scholars that we're whose work we're familiar with. So this Thursday, 11 to 1, we'll be in conversation with Dr. Venus Evans Winters. And we're excited because our focus is going to be on the triumphs and challenges of Black girls specifically. And we're really also interested in talking about pathways of healing for our communities, kind of building on some of the conversation that we had with Dr. Sean Jenright when he talked about healing-centered practice in the after-school space. So we're really excited about this conversation this Thursday. If you want more information, you can visit edutainmentforequity.com. That's edutainmentforequity.com. And you can get tickets, get access to what's going on. It's all going to be on Zoom. So that's what's the most exciting, is that we get to have folks like Venus portal into the Bay real quick and share her genius. So that's what this is about.
Real talk. And Dr. V, Venus Evans Winters, how do we get a hold of you directly?
Yes, thanks, Dave. So you can find me at venusevanswinters.com. I'm also on Instagram as at Empress Dr. Venus, Empress Dr. Venus. Yes, I was ordained an empress by the International Rastafarian Society because of the work that I do, not just here in the United States, but I've done healing work all across the continent, South Africa, not all across South Africa, and Ghana in particular, very conscientious about the work that I do in bridging all of these worlds. I'm also on Twitter at Dr. V. Evans Winters. And also I'm the founder of Planet Venus Institute. You could go to planetvenusinstitute.com.
Okay, there you have it. The Empress reminds me of my MC days when I couldn't be a Grand Master, so I was the Grand Emperor. Remember from the month of May to December.
I'm gonna go look that up. If you got a MySpace, man, I'm gonna look that up.
Somebody got a tape somewhere, you know. I try to buy them off the market so it don't get out. But that was my rhyme.
Oh no.
Well, look, I appreciate both of y'all coming on, Hadari Davis from Edutainment for Equity and Dr. Venus Evans Winters, thank you very much. The author of many books, including A Boss Chick's Guide to Mindfulness Meditation and Teaching Black Girls. And Thursday, between 11 and 1, they'll be in deep conversation. So we're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We will be right back.